Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. We may be at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, but this is, you know, a joint event between the Dutch government and the Migration Policy Institute, of which I am the president. My name is Dimitri Papadimitriou. The name of the event this afternoon is Sharing Lessons, Sharing Responsibility, Combating Human Trafficking. I know that by the mere fact that you're here, it is self-evident that you care about this topic and you care about this topic deeply. I think an awful lot of people care about this topic, but in this big arguments and debates that we have in our country, this becomes a bit of a niche issue. But being a niche issue does not make it any less of a critical issue for us to consider. And today we have the pleasure of having with us a delegation from the Netherlands that is particularly well equipped to speak to the issue, talk to us about a model of enforcement and detection and prevention that they have developed and tested in the Netherlands. Some of the authors and the principals of this model are either up here or in the audience, or I should say in combination up here and in the audience. And we're going to try to keep remarks brief. This way we can really have a conversation, which is, as we all know, the part of any event that is the most interesting and from which we most learn. There are five people in the audience who are experts on these issues, three from the Netherlands and two from the United States. And of course, I will be the moderator of the session. You need a moderator anyway. The order in which the speakers will make their comments is as follows. Corinne Detmeyer will go first. She's the National Rapporteur for Human Trafficking in the Netherlands. She's also been a judge, and a senior judge, in fact, in administrative and senior judge positions for a number of years. We're not going to be more specific on that. How is that?
More than enough.
She will be followed by Herman Bolhar, who is the chair of the Dutch Public Prosecution Service. And the title is, you know, not exactly easy to translate into Americanese, but he is the chief prosecutor of the country of the Netherlands. They're going to be followed by Jane Nady Sigmund, who is the senior advisor to the director of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, U.S. Department of State. I apologize for having to read these things, but there are just too many words in that title. So we would just, call it the traffic anti-trafficking czar. How is that? And Jack Blakey, who is the chief of the Special Prosecution Bureau in Cook County, Illinois State's Attorney Office. We're also joined here on the panel by Rick Bick, the Deputy Chief of the National Police of the Netherlands. He will be making some remarks, but the others will be probably taken, if you don't mind, about 10 minutes in making your remarks. And I don't cut people off. We're all adults here. When I look at you a certain way, you will know that it's time for you to stop. And if you don't get that, then we'll appoint someone from the audience to enforce the law. Why don't we start then?
Thank you. And we've already said that this afternoon how grateful we are for this opportunity, and I think that when we talked about what we had learned this afternoon in the session we had during the day, we had 15 minutes to give our view, all of us, and it took half an hour, and that was because we had learned so much. Internationally, the fight against trafficking in human beings is often put into the perspective of the three P's: prevention, prosecution, and the protection of victims. And over the years, the P's of punishment and partnership have been added. And today, I would like to characterize the Dutch approach with the use of another letter of the alphabet. I had the choice, well, the choice I put to myself, between the C of the criminal, and the V of the victim. I went for the C. That's mostly as a result of practical reasons. And I came up with six C's that characterize the Dutch approach of human trafficking. It's about your chain partners, knowing your chain partners, knowing the other stakeholders in the field. It's about commitment, commitment of all these chain partners to the overall goal. It's about capacity, which includes expertise and allotting means, putting your money where your mouth is. Cooperation, which must also include the exchange of information, including operational information, and speaking the same language. Creativity, bearing in mind that criminals will always be more inventive than the government officials are. And consolidation, share best practices, but also negative results. In 2006, the so-called Snape case, a large trafficking case discussed earlier this day, illustrated that the law enforcement approach to combat trafficking, well, that alone is not sufficient. It must be reinforced by, for instance, an administrative and a fiscal approach. And the effectiveness of this approach has been proven in the Netherlands in several pilots. And during these pilots, different partners experimented with the so-called integrated approach, multidisciplinary integrated approach. And the pilots proved that the programmatic approach is a step forward in the fight against human trafficking. Why? Well, what constitutes the success in this programmatic approach? These six C's that I told you about could be derived from the analysis of the seven pilots that have been in practice during the last years. Chain partners. Well, the first step is to identify the partners who can and must play a role in tackling human trafficking. The choice of partners varies according to the specific form of human trafficking at hand. For instance, in the labor exploitation on a ship, you need other partners than when you're talking about sexual exploitation within hotels. In the latter, you would need the hotels to partner up with, and other private enterprises. If you're talking about labor exploitation, your partners could also be the trade unions, the chambers of commerce, but also the labor inspectorate. And the partners that you choose the choice that you make must be based on the barriers you want to put up in order to prevent these traffickers from doing what they want to do. Commitment. The partners must commit to the overall goal. Well, that may cause a problem because different views arising during the process could lead to partners withdrawing their commitment. Because at times, their own specific goals could conflict with the overall goal of the pilot. And for an effective approach, such a withdrawal could be, of course, disastrous. Commitment at the beginning is not a given for an enduring commitment. Commitment needs maintaining. Earlier this afternoon, a joke was made about the comparison to a marriage. Well, I think you can understand that the maintaining of commitment in a marriage is something that bears little similarity to this commitment in working together in this fight against human trafficking. Capacity. Be specific about your expectations. And this goes for the deployment of capacity, expertise, and means. If this is not clear at the start, this could easily result in a partner withdrawing from the cooperation. And if we're talking about this cooperation, there are some important factors to emphasize. I will name five. You need one partner to take the lead. Otherwise, it will just be talking together, going home, going about your own business, not having any results to speak of. So one partner really has to take the lead. And at the start, it's necessary to map out the problem and to talk about what information can be shared freely. Preferably, all information should be shared. Now, this is something that is, for some partners, a bridge too far. But what's important to know is that every partner in this partnership can identify and intervene and holds a piece of the puzzle, and you need to get this whole picture. And then, of course, create trust between partners. And trust is something, well, that two needs working on. If you have a group that convenes on a weekly weekly basis to talk about the progress that you make, and one or two of the partners hardly ever shows up, that trust will not be there. You can put that in writing, but if it's not dealt with in person, well, you are left with hardly anything. Every partner has to act according to his own rights and powers. And that should also be clear from the start, because if you execute powers that are really not within your jurisdiction, so to speak, then in the end you can come up with results that will not hold up in court. Start with a success. Start with a low-hanging fruit, so to speak, because that will motivate your partners to go on in this partnership. And then, we talked about this afternoon also, share the success with all the partners. One of the success stories in the Netherlands was in The Hague, where it was the housing committee that really led to the a discovery of a large labor exploitation case. And of course, it's very easy for the police or the prosecution to take all the credit. And it's so much stronger if you put the credit there where it belongs, with the housing committee of the municipality. And of course, that was the start. And then the rest of the success should be shared by all. And what's very important is the creativity. That too we talked about today. Criminals are constantly finding new ways of making money and keeping under the radar. And that means that law enforcement and other stakeholders need to be creative and innovative. That involves new insights and knowledge. And then in the end, you need to consolidate what you have learned and what you have found. And it's important to learn from these new ways of combating trafficking. Think that that can and should be done with the assistance of the academic world. Today was a wonderful example of how the academic world, together with the partners in crime, against crime, can really step up this joint effort. But it's equally important to show the public what you're doing and why trafficking is a problem that should concern the whole of society. And then we're back to commitment, because we need the commitment of the whole of society, a shared moral commitment. Thank you.
thank you very much, Corinne, for this very clear presentation. And perhaps since we're into C's and since you had six, may I add perhaps for your consideration a seventh C. And the C is consumers and consumption. Ultimately, it is the consumer who is willing to pay for the services and the goods of produced by people who are trafficked. And I think it's extremely important for public education so that consumers know what it is that they're buying. If they buy something too cheaply, there could only be two or three possible explanations for it. One would be that's a fake product and it's going to break on your way home. The second one, perhaps, is that it's a stolen product and you could be in trouble. The third one is that it has been produced under extreme coercion. So I think this is extremely important for us to also keep in mind. Thank you very much. And Herman, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for being here and taking interest in this important subject. The story I'm going to tell you and the remarks I'm going to make have all to do with the story of the Dutch National Task Force on Human Trafficking that I've been chairing now for about 5 or 6 years. The task force was established in 2008 and first consisted of talking about peace, at least two P's, the police and the public prosecution service. Oh, there's three P's already. The national rapporteur. The reason that the task force came to life had to do with this special case we came across as the prosecution service, so-called, we call it SNAPER, and you might pronounce it a SNEEP case. It had to do with prosecutions, exploitation in Amsterdam, city of Amsterdam, city of Utrecht, and city of Alkmaar. And I'm very happy that one of the most prominent members of the task force, the mayor of Alkmaar, Mr. Piet Bruinhoog, is in our midst today. Elaborating some more on peace, after the task force was established and what we discovered from this specific case was the importance of three other P's. The P of professionalism in prosecution, and I'm accompanied by two of the most outstanding prosecutors in the Dutch prosecution service, my two colleagues who were very, very involved in this case. But professionalism in prosecution is the first place you need it. What we strive for, and have been striving for ever since, and coming back on the reason why the task force has come to life, is problem orientation and creating partnerships. And then I'm back with the task force. From the three parties that were involved in the task force in 2008, the task force consists now of almost 20 members, and almost every agency, government and non-governmental agencies, are involved right now in a process that has been taking now for about 6 years. And it all has to do with these widening views about problem orientation and partnerships. Because from the prosecution's point of view, and we should never forget that it's an important issue and an important task we have to fulfill, it's about punishment. But also, it has to do, and our task is also, to prevent repetition. And saying so, you need partners. You need partners, and you need to raise awareness among all the partners involved. What we have discovered in this field of human trafficking, that often via a criminal case, we detect a very confronting, complex, and inconvenient reality, you might say. It's a harsh reality with the question, does anybody know besides the professional involved police and prosecution service? Do we know? Do you know? And if you know, do we accept these things? These were the most important questions we asked ourselves, and asked ourselves in the task force, and asked ourselves in the prosecution service. We came to the conclusion that the things we saw needed to pose a question about, do we want to share responsibilities? And who feels responsible? That's, in short, we have been doing ever since. We try to detect and create barriers among all the partners involved, partners that could be involved in transportation, in visa, in labor permits, in housing questions. And the question is, who can raise and uphold a certain barrier? Quite a new theme in this way of thinking is that we have become more and more victim-oriented. Victim orientation is extremely important, so to provide help and provide refuge to victims that are often traumatized. One of the issues that the task force has played a role in is on the matter of prevention is create ways to give information also to potential victims in specific source countries. In Europe, it's countries like Romania, Hungary, Poland, and Bulgaria most of the time. To prevent people to step in all those stories of employers, so-called employers, who give them the impression there could be a land of make-belief that's better and creates better opportunities for all those people, create a job and give them sources that they often don't have in their country of origin. But it certainly is a land of make-believe. But when they are there, they come to the conclusion that it's a very cruel life, and then once you're in, you can't step out anymore. All these initiatives have the effect that we've widened our views, and we have detected many other partners involved that create a broad coalition against exploitation, because that's what it's all about. It's about exploitation. And I'm very proud to say that the most recent member of the task force are the Chambers of Commerce, because when you were talking about labor and labor permits, we have to have the Chambers of Commerce aboard to create another barrier in that respect. Ladies and gentlemen, in my opinion, we're talking about the most important of all human rights, is the right that gives you the guarantee of freedom of slavery. We should build barriers and partnerships and create opportunities for sustainability and upholding this specific right. Is that right that's in danger? We're all in danger. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Herman. And Jane?
What letter?
How about Jay?
Well, I think Jay is most appropriate. Jay. I'm Jane, Jane Sigmund from the Trafficking in Persons Office. And for those of you who know our office, well, you know, we changed from GTIP to JTIP recently, and that was not because of me and my name. That was because we came under our undersecretary's office was renamed from Global Affairs to include a stronger justice mandate. Hence, we are now JTIP. So I think I'll be J. If that's all right.
So G is no longer the...
We're no longer GTIP. We are now
so
JTIP.
Yes.
Right. I'm really pleased to be here. I'm very pleased to be on this panel with these distinguished Dutch colleagues and to have spent the day earlier today in dialogue with them and also with my colleague, Mr. Blakey, from Chicago. I think everybody who we spent time with today, and especially on this panel, has spent a huge amount of years collectively being committed to finding the most effective and innovative ways to combat human trafficking. And I very much appreciate the Migration Policy Institute's leadership in managing this and assisting in hosting, and the Carnegie Endowment, too, for lending us this room tonight. I think it's a great opportunity for us to kind of take stock. My Dutch colleagues are, as I said, here to discuss their initiatives and model for combating trafficking. I'm from the Trafficking in Persons Office at the State Department, and I'm going to take a more global perspective and share with you some lessons learned as we look across the world. I'm going to talk some about shared responsibility, which is a big theme here tonight, and innovation and partnerships, which we could not be effective in doing this work without those. It's clear that just as we look in terms of where we've been over the last 12 years since the Palermo Protocol and the Trafficking Victims Protection Act made a tremendous amount of progress. Most countries are party to the protocol, and most countries have enacted statutes that criminalize human trafficking. Both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. And this represents remarkable global consensus on the significance of this crime and the response and what it should be. And there's also a growing consensus, even though many countries do not put specific victim protections in their law, there is a growing consensus that victims around the world, that victims should be protected. They need assistance because of their status as victims, because of their vulnerability to reprisals, and because their cooperation is essential for successful prosecutions. But of greatest concern as we look around the world is the fact that we're not reaching enough victims, enough people who are enslaved, and too few victims are identified in every country. In the United States, we struggle with this, and I know the Netherlands does this too, as well, and all countries around the world. An estimated 42,000 individuals were identified as victims globally this last year in the Trafficking in Persons Report, which is a paltry sum in comparison to the estimated 21 million victims of human trafficking worldwide. And in addition, the vast majority of traffickers are able to operate with impunity, aware that that the profits that they will earn outweigh the risks and the consequences that they may suffer should they be detected. Less than 8,000 prosecutions globally and about 4,000 convictions worldwide. So clearly, we have a long way to go, and only 6% of those are for forced labor. So this gives us pause with regard to where to put our efforts. So I just want to begin with some lessons learned, because as we move forward, and this is my theme at the end, as we move forward, the innovations and partnerships we build must build on the lessons that we have learned thus far. So lessons that we've learned. We've learned to listen to survivors. We've learned that victim service providers and survivors have helped us to understand this phenomenon of trafficking, what they experience, and how we can improve services and policy. We've learned that proactive, systematic efforts at victim identification identify more victims, and that survivors have taught us, we've seen this in the research, all the many times that they've come into contact with various professionals and they were not identified, their situation was not identified. We've learned that specialized investigation and prosecution actually produces results. It produces more successful prosecutions, but that training is really essential for that to go well. And interagency collaboration work that produces the best results. We spent a lot of time this afternoon talking about in the U.S., we are trying to move toward a whole-of-government response so that all agencies are involved and that we recognize that there's a role for everyone. We also know that strong NGO government coordination is needed. And law enforcement has told us repeatedly in research that they depend on NGOs to protect and assist victims and to provide the services that they need, and that they are essential to successful prosecutions. We clearly need more alternative models for promoting community integration and expanding the work and livelihood options for survivors. And while identification of forced labor is increasing in many countries, we clearly need enhanced efforts to improve the amount what we're doing in terms of this is the area that law enforcement, labor, and prosecutors working together have the least amount of experience with. So it is a shared responsibility. We're very clear in the United States that government cannot do this alone. And government has the responsibility to enact the laws, enforce the laws, and provide the legal recourse for victims, but we cannot mount the response alone. It's obvious to all of us it's going to take partnerships with an ever-widening array of stakeholders, and I mean ever-widening. It's only been in the last year or two that the Department of Education has become a member of our task force because we've come to realize how important it is to have messaging of prevention in our schools with regard to particularly with minor sex trafficking. So it's going to take collaboration and cooperation to produce effective practices and innovation to drive things forward. I think all of you who are here from the United States may be aware that President Obama has really been out front on this issue. He delivered a major speech in which he talked about the fact that our fight against human trafficking is one of the great human rights causes of our time, and the United States will continue to lead it. And he has, through partnerships, by the way, but because we constantly are working with other governments, and, I mean, every imaginable partner, I would say. The president's message has consistently conveyed that everybody has a role in combating trafficking. And in the United States, what this translates into is the steps that he took in the executive order to strengthen protections against trafficking by federal contractors and subcontractors, developing a new strategic action plan for services for victims of trafficking, which was just recently published and is open for public comment. I would encourage all of you to review it. It shows that our commitment to looking at the way we're doing things when we know we can do it better. More prosecutions than ever before, increased diplomatic engagement, and also targeted foreign assistance. Last week, the White House hosted a forum on trafficking and brought people in from around the country, leaders from many sectors across government and the civil society and the private sector, to help chart a course forward with regard to how to address this crime. And the president announced, the first presidential awards for extraordinary efforts to combat human trafficking were announced. And one of the recipients is a pioneer in victim services, a woman named Flory Burke, who's probably known to many of you in this room. She's been a stalwart advocate for more than 15 years, helped develop services, groundbreaking services in 2001, and was a founding member of the Freedom Network USA. The second award was given to a private sector partner that has led the way in the business community. Carlson, a global hospitality and travel company operating in 150 countries, was organized for its role as the foremost leader in combating modern slavery in the travel and tourism industry. Carlson adopted and promoted business practices to seek to protect victims of human trafficking. And in 2004, Carlson was the first company to sign the Code of Conduct for Protection of Children from Sexual Exploitation in Travel and Tourism. So increasingly, companies are seeing that this is good business. It's not bad for business to be involved in this way. And more than 1,200 companies in 46 countries have signed the Child Protection Code of Conduct. So the private sector clearly has become one of the partners and plays a very significant role. And businesses and NGOs and government are combining efforts now to look at issues related to codes of conduct and supply chain monitoring. Since groundbreaking legislation signed in California 2 years ago, many companies are taking steps to evaluate and address the risks of human trafficking in their supply chains and adopt more transparent processes. Verite is an NGO that has been an outstanding leader in this, and they're one of the many websites you can go to that you can develop. They develop tools for identifying risk factors for human trafficking and forced labor among migrant workers that companies might employ. Their tool is called the Fair Hiring Tool. The application of this kind of resource is spreading at the same time that we see that consumers are signaling that they're willing to pay a fair price for products that are not exploitation-free. Another way in which the private sector has a most important role is in mentoring survivors, providing job training, and, in fact, hiring survivors. We have been working with a group called a British group called the International Business Leaders Forum, which trains youth at risk for jobs in the hotel industry. And they are partnering in Mexico and Vietnam with NGOs serving trafficking survivors to help them receive this training and, in fact, to find successful job placements. My boss is fond of saying that a job is one of the best forms of therapy for a trafficking victim. Innovation plays a really important role as we're moving forward. There's no question that everybody is Everyone, all of the countries that we interact with globally are trying to improve public awareness. One of our projects, the Save Slavery Footprint Project, I know we talk about it quite a lot. There's a website called slaveryfootprint.org. It's an online tool that allows the general public to go on and learn about human trafficking and how it is that trafficking may touch an individual's lives through the clothes that they wear or the foods that they eat or the technology that they rely on every day. And it then allows them to take action after they've taken a survey that essentially applies an algorithm to help them to identify how many slaves have touched your life. Around the world, then they can send messages to companies and become active, saying things like, "I like what you sell. I want to keep buying this product, and I care about slavery, and you as a company should too." When we launched this about a year and a half ago, we set as a goal 150,000 hits on this website in the first year. It's been about a year and a half. We're up to 4.6 million hits on this website. So almost every country, 190 countries, have individuals from those countries have hit this. What this does is open up the specter of worldwide awareness raising and education that the power of the Internet can provide. We see also there's some exciting new things happening with the National Human Trafficking Resource Center. Hotline that's operated by the Polaris Project here in the United States. You know, they have they're really a model hotline for the world. They are connected to 2,700 service providers, and they take reports, tips regarding suspicious activity from individuals who might suspect that there might be a trafficking situation. They've received more than 75,000 calls since they got started and have connected more than 8,300 victims with assistance and support and reported nearly 3,000 cases to law enforcement. Now, this hotline is partially funded by – are you looking at me this
yes.
way? You are. Okay. You are looking at me this way. The hotline is partially – I am going to close momentarily. The hotline is partially funded, but I want to tell you that there's now a collaboration, and Google has thrown in another $3 million to enable them to connect with hotlines in Asia and Europe, so they can share information more globally. And I think we're building a global network of hotlines. They also have this exciting new SMS text technology so that victims can text, and a person who might not be free to open her mouth and make a call can actually text now and be texted back, because the text will go immediately to the hotline. I want to just say a word about partnerships. We've had, I guess I can't really say enough about partnerships, but I will say very little as I look at Dimitri. One of the most exciting new partnerships that our office has just launched is a partnership with a law firm, DLA Piper. They formed a nonprofit called New Perimeter. And they are developing a network of pro bono legal services for victims. And it's our way of trying to apply the potential of the global reach of 4,000 lawyers in 30 countries of that firm to work in partnership with NGOs and provide legal services. So as we go forward, I just want to say that I am actually optimistic. Some of my colleagues are pragmatic optimistics, I learned today. But I'm really quite optimistic because the movement is growing beyond the few who work in this field to the general public. And I think there's proof in this. You can see it in the networking on the Internet and the number of hits we have on our website. As we move forward, there's no question that we need more and more partnerships, and we need partnerships and innovations that build on the effective strategies that we've identified and the lessons learned that we have in the past decade. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. And maybe, you know, you have been or you are still an academic, you know. The academics have a terrific way of sort of saying, I'm finishing. In summary, to recap, very well done. And one of the things that that I was particularly interested in addition to this rich set of ideas that you put on the table, is the whole of government approach. I mean, ultimately, you need the entire government to engage on the issue at all levels and across, but you also need the whole of society. And it's not enough for some specialized NGOs to be doing this work. It's not enough for the NGOs to work with the government and vice versa. The NGOs that put those issues on the table must persuade their fellow members of the civil society that regardless of what it is that they do, they must also pay attention and advocate for a better future for all of those people who are affected by human trafficking. So I felt compelled to say that because naming and shaming, when it is done by the civil society across the entire society, can be extremely effective. Sorry, I didn't mean to take any time. You still have, Jack, you still have your 10 minutes.
Thank you. In the workshop today, we found that leadership is the process of putting people who need to change in the unavoidable path of learning. And little did I know the unavoidable path that I began when I boarded my plane in Chicago. And for that, I'd like to thank my hosts here today, both from the Dutch government and from my own government. Because to come from Chicago and to find that other systems, other nations, other cultures are arriving at the same approaches for an intractable problem is a gift of faith. It lets us know that perhaps while we're on this path, that we might be headed in the right direction. And there were two central insights that I found today. And if I could relate them to the path we're walking in Chicago, because I feel that my presence here is to be the voice of the American heartland to some degree, to be some voice from outside the Beltway. And so I'll try to put it in terms of what our experience is in the Chicago approach or the Chicago way. The first insight I think that we all share today in the workshop and I think in my work as well is that the criminal justice system is not an end-all. It is not the method by which this problem will be solved in isolation. We cannot arrest ourselves out of any problem, social or otherwise, certainly not something as intractable as human trafficking. Nevertheless, it is an intrinsic piece of the solution. It must be, and it must always be, part of the solution from a collective standpoint, from society, from our legal systems, from our social mores. And I believe that we can do that, but in order to do that, we have to learn lessons. We have to be on that path of learning. And the way I think we've done it with human trafficking and are continuing to do it is what's called the collaborative model. Collaborative model includes agents and actors outside the criminal justice system working in collaboration. Years ago, when advocates began to show the criminal justice system that their response to domestic violence was lacking, there was a change. There was a change in the way we prosecuted those cases, the way we investigated them. And now, 30 years later, we bear the changes that were brought about by advocates, people outside the criminal justice system. And now, what we normally do in those cases is change fundamentally, forever. By the same token, the way we approach sexual assault changed because of advocates. People outside the criminal justice system who saw that what we were doing in the law was not enough. We developed rape shield laws. We developed ways of investigating and prosecuting. The way we handle those cases now has forever changed. In Chicago, I'm the bureau chief for the second largest prosecution office in the country. We do tens of thousands of felonies every year. We process, as I mentioned earlier today, last year, 500 murders. We have 100,000 gang members, heavily armed. We have before us a difficult path. Unfortunately, human trafficking is part of that. But by learning the lessons from domestic violence and the theories behind it, learning the lessons of sexual assault and the way we handle those cases, and then applying something new, applying the tools that law enforcement has developed to attack organized crime, to not merely address individual incidents and individual offenders, going after rank and file in basically an endless cycle of incarceration. We can now target entities as the target. Enterprise criminality, the use of criminal electronic surveillance technology, and actually develop a victim-centered but not victim-built case in which the victim's voice is important, but we don't put all the weight of the case or in its success and failure on the burdens of perhaps a child who's been subjected not only to rape but mass rape, who's been subjected to torture. That's a burden we can't place on children, certainly in the domestic sex trafficking, and very often with labor trafficking. When a person's culturally and linguistically isolated, there are simply some burdens that the criminal justice system cannot and should not place on them. But we have the tools. We have begun the path. There is an approach with electronic surveillance, racketeering, financial investigations, that if we do it in a victim-informed way, learning the lessons from our survivor voices, I believe that we can move forward. And what we'll do, and what I feel is happening elsewhere, certainly after today that my beliefs confirmed, is that we're striking a balance in our collaborative partnerships between inclusion, sufficient inclusion to have the capacity to render services and to enter various portions of our society in the right way, and then also striking a balance with that, with having shaped channels of communication. Instead of having 1,000 bridges across the river, we have key bridges at particular points, so that the communication between the NGO community and the law enforcement community can be controlled and interpreted properly. Very often when we try to build gaps, culture gaps, or build bridges across culture gaps, there's confusion, there's misunderstanding, there's negative experiences, and it all too often those types of experiences can destroy crossing the river. Too often an NGO will have a negative experience with one law enforcement person and then they're forever write them off. By the same token, a law enforcement person will have a negative experience with an NGO, and again, the communication is broken. But if we have structured channels of communication and clear boundaries regarding mission statements and responsibilities, I believe we can create structures that survive personality, a change in personality. Very often, a charismatic leader or a very motivated person can bring about a lot of institutional and entity change, but when that person leaves, the communication is gone. So is the bridge. But I believe with a collaborative model, as I said, learning the lessons of DV and sex crimes and applying the tools of organized crime, we can have a new approach to identify and prosecute traffickers. And from a law enforcement standpoint, change our notion of what a positive outcome is. So often I have hundreds of people that work for me doing cases. And so often they get disappointed when there's not an arrest or a conviction. And I tell them, the reason you became a public servant, the reason you're underpaid and overworked is because you set out to be the voice of victims. And that calling is never more important than when you are the victim or the voice of the victims of slavery, in particular children. And when they recover a victim, I never say rescue, I say recover. When we recover one who begins their own path to recovery, because in real ways, our survivors will save themselves. You've earned your pay for the day, and that's the only stat that matters. I believe that when we go forward today with our new partnerships, both international and national, I think we're on the right path. Certainly, I don't think we've solved anything, but I think we're certainly going in the right direction, and I'd like to thank my host for everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Reid, I will give you the floor to make any remarks you would like to make, perhaps respond to some of the things that you've heard.
If you don't mind, I keep seated. And
yes, please do.
In addition, I have three remarks, three observations. I learned a lot today and also the last 5 years when this specific phenomenon is in my responsibility in the Dutch police. And the first observation is that we should all, as partners and disciplines, emphasize that we have to deal with a moral issue and not just a common felony. It's all about framing the problem. And framing the problem is a specific ability we as top-level executive should be able to address the political agenda. So it is not only, so moral entrepreneurship is not only a monopoly of one of the partners. We can all address to the political agenda and to each other that we have to deal with a very moral issue. It always starts with a case. So the narrative concept, the narrative aspect can help, such as the case we dealt with today showed us. Secondly, essential is a common perspective of all partners to the same goals and the same value proposition. We cannot have the ambition to eliminate slavery in the world today. That ambition is too big. But we can combat slavery more effective than we do at this moment if we have the same goals and the same value propositions. For instance, weakening facilities, or as Jack Blakey just told, a more victim-centered approach, and maybe also disturbing markets. When we have a common perspective on that, that can guide our mutual actions. It also can guide our operational cooperation, and it can also focus on the similarities of all the agencies involved instead of the differences. Thirdly, operational capacity building, in my opinion, is vital. We all have to deal with enormous cuts on the budgets. So we have to have a combined effort on this problem. And it all begins with intelligence sharing what is going on in the world outside. I heard a number of good ideas today, such as anti-trafficking coordination teams in the United States, and when top-level executives should connect more with the street-level practice, with the street-level reality, I think we can gain more effect than we do at this moment. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bert. And so I'm going to give you a chance to sort of gather your thoughts and prepare your questions. So I'm expecting to see 30 hands up in the air in 2 minutes. Because I'd like to use the prerogative of the moderator, the chair, to make a couple of remarks myself, which may be obvious to those of you who sort of live this issue day to day or are heavily engaged in this, but it might not be, they might not be as obvious to those who sort of parachute in and out of many issues. I know that money is scarce. I know that the will is there. And I know that when will combines with money, you have to, in a sense, do a bit of a triage. What are you going to spend your money on? But when you have more money, perhaps, than you have now, it might be useful if you were to think more systematically about how to institutionalize, perhaps, you know, in a clearinghouse of good practices, basically takes ideas, abstracts them out, because, you know, if you simply copy something from another country and forget all the circumstances that made it successful there, you're likely to be disappointed. But nonetheless, a clearinghouse of good practice would be something that can then be useful to a much larger group of people. I also wanted to say something about prevention. I know that many of you, most of you here, at least among our Dutch colleagues, are law enforcement and, you know, prosecutors and what have you. But in other parts of life, perhaps you already do it in years, we use risk management models, which are based on a lot of information to build profiles of all of the key actors. In the topics in which we're discussing. And the more information you feed into these models, the more accurate they become. And they can be risk management models in terms of who, what, perhaps, how a trafficked victim behaves, what a trafficker, perhaps, if not looks like, but how he or she behaves, and together with a set of ideas, again, that you can indigenize, you can adapt and make your own, start focusing not at the other end, but at the front end of the entire process, the prevention, because ultimately it seems to me there will always be limitations when you try to catch the process in the middle and then take it to the end. Ultimately, we have to create opportunities for us to prevent those things from happening in the first places. And I also wanted, the last point I will make, to make the connection of trafficking to illegal immigration. Most illegal immigration today is assisted. It is not casual. People don't just, you know, sort of decide to take a swim across river or rivers or, you know, a sea or sort of get into a whatever, an airplane and go to another country. And because it costs more and more money for those who assist illegal immigrants to bring them to our places. And since people don't have an unlimited amount of money to pay for those things up front, the collection process comes afterwards. This is where sexual exploitation, this is where exploitation of all types takes place. Slavery is often the result of illegal immigration. So I know that perhaps, you know, the remit, the mandate for many of you in your offices may not be illegal immigration, but I would really hope that you're going to really think a bit more broadly about it and also focus on illegal immigration. Thank you very much. Now, there were two hands I had seen already, so I'm going to start creating a chart here. Whoever was, go ahead.
First, I just want to thank the Migration Policy Institute for a wonderful panel. I always enjoy attending these events. My name is Dr. Kimberly Melman Orozco. I have a PhD in Criminology, Law, and Society from George Mason University. I teach at University of Maryland College Park, and I'm here representing the Justicia Institute. The key theme that I saw across the panelists was sharing information, partnerships, consolidating information, intelligence sharing. It seemed that each one of you had mentioned these elements. And perhaps I'm a pessimist, but in my experience, I have not seen that. I wrote down my question to be as concise as possible.
Can I interrupt you? Are you a pragmatic pessimist or just a pessimist?
We'll see at the end of this event.
Okay,
we'll see.
We'll
once I meet some more people. So there are very few organizations systematically collecting data on human trafficking. Obtaining data, this raw data, in my experience, is difficult, if not impossible. For example, Ms. Sigmund had mentioned the National Human Trafficking Resource Center, which is operated by the Polaris Project. Just last week, I petitioned their deputy director again to obtain non-confidential aggregate-level data to perform our external analysis. I was told, and I quote, "We don't have to because it's not a requirement of the grant." My question for you, Jane, and also for Herman, is first, Jane, what impact do you think this lack of data sharing has on the ability of researchers to inform policy and practice? And then for Herman, how is the Netherlands similar or different to the United States in respect to data sharing? Is data easily accessible for nonprofits like ours to access it and produce evidence-based research that is disseminated to the public? Or is it equally as difficult? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I'm actually focused more outside the U.S. as not a State Department. I'm not familiar with the operation, what the rules are with regard to that project, but I will certainly carry that message, and maybe we could talk after the session. But I will say our office has supported one of the largest databases in the world, the IOM's database on victims of trafficking that have been served by IOM missions. I think it's certainly scores of missions. They've got tens of thousands of cases now since 2000. And it's my understanding that they will permit people of serious intent to access, you have to go through their process of requesting they don't actually, it's my understanding that they, I used to oversee that project, but I don't so much anymore. But it's my understanding they allow researchers to have access to the database, but they will in fact collaborate with what researchers are looking for. So that is one that we have supported over over 4 or 5 years, and because it's such a unique database, and we have seen many research reports come out of that database, sharing, helping us to understand some of the patterns, helping us to get a clearer picture. You know, it's the only database that I know of that can give us a global picture of the evolving, increasing number of forced labor victims that they are assisting. In some countries, there are actually more males than females now that they are assisting. So we've definitely had the opportunity to look at global patterns, and I'd be happy to talk with you about accessing that.
I can actually talk about that as well. A lot of the federal funding requires, at least now out in the field, that certain data points be collected, and that stuff is in the process of being pushed out to individuals. There's a distinction to be made between numbers of victims and criminal intelligence. Obviously, criminal intelligence is going nowhere. It needs to be protected. But I think ultimately when these funding tied to data is actually pushed out into the state and local level, that we'll actually start getting better numbers. We're not going to get great numbers. It's like estimating how much drugs are coming into the United States. People are not declaring the kilos at the border. But we can get more informed numbers, ultimately. And I think the same thing will be true of trafficking. Mm-hmm. We're never going to get hard numbers for hard data, but we'll get meaningful data. And I think that process is underway.
Just to follow up, I think that there is accessible descriptive level information, so numbers, but you know, having access to those data sources facilitates extremely innovative research. For example, hotspot crime mapping that determines risk analysis by location of where there's being victims reported and what are the variables associated with those locations that can inform law enforcement. So where should they deploy their practices? And this is the innovative research that academics throughout the field are coming up with, but the barrier I see is just information.
Yes and no. I think predictive analytics and a lot of that's happening in-house, but it's not something that we can share with. For example, some information is protected by statute or constitution requirements. I can't give tax information to grand jury information. And a lot of the meaningful data, especially in relation to predictive analytics and hotspots and CompStat approach to crime fighting, has to take into account a lot of data which is just not legally accessible to the private sector.
Well, thank you very much for this extremely important question, I think, because, as a matter of fact, from our prosecutor's point of view in the Netherlands, you might say that we have made a shift, and we're still shifting from, you might say, be as closed as possible towards be as open as possible. That's the track we are on towards openness. When you want to share the problem with as many partners as you would like, then the first thing is sharing information as much as possible. And of course, there are lots of dilemmas on the side of the openness in respect to defendants' rights and possible contempt of court, like risks in this criminal case you're prosecuting. Of course, but being aware of those dilemmas, and that's why you need outstanding professionals in the prosecutor's office. We in the Netherlands, we have privacy laws that allow us to make certain protocols between parties involved that allow us to share information on a acceptable, quite acceptable level. And a quite recent development is that we have created what we call regional information centers, and these regional information centers are specifically erected bodies to provide local government with the information from our criminal cases they might need to come across questions you raised about the things you might need to take preventive measures and also to provide academics or other people with ways to analyze cases and so on. But I'd like Corinne Detmeyer to elaborate some more on this issue, because from the national rapporteur's point of view, there is a lot to be said, I think, about this issue.
Thank you. Yes, of course, data is extremely important, and I have issued a report on data by the end of last year, and it will be it is in the process of being translated into English, and it will be found on my website within a few weeks. What my bureau does is collect data from victims, NGOs from victims, and from the prosecution office. We do secondary analysis on these data. And we also look at the international data. What we see in the EU, for instance, is that there's a huge cry for comparative data, because we want to know how does one country do in comparison to another. And one of the problems that we have is that those data are not collected in the same way. For instance, in Portugal, the data on victims represent victims that have figured in a court case. So that means that that there has been a conviction, and that the victim has been truly established as a victim. Whereas in the Netherlands, we look at the data of victims that have been identified as a victim, but we don't really know yet at that time the follow-up. But even if we do, it's the identification process that we are very much interested in. So to compare the victims of the Netherlands to those of Portugal, you get nothing. Now, there are very interesting academic endeavors to disseminate those data in order to be able to compare them. One of those endeavors is called Montrasec, which has been developed by EU money, and that would give you a day-to-day overview of not only victims but also perpetrators and situations. Now, this is an extremely expensive form of data gathering that has been developed but has not been put into practice. But I agree completely with you the importance of this. And what we also have looked at is the estimates of data. ILO has done an estimate that we have criticized, but it's the best estimate that has been done up to now. It's still not really valid, but it's better than what we've had. So yes, I think data will tell us in what direction to look for the best way to combat trafficking, or the best way to help victims, to keep them from being re-victimized.
I'd also like to thank MPI. My name is Anne Goldstein. I'm with the International Association of Women Judges, which, thanks to the generosity of JTIP, is training judges and magistrates in Haiti on human trafficking. I have two quick questions, I think primarily for Ms. Sigmund. The first refers to something Mr. Blakey raised, the metric that JTIP uses for evaluating countries' performance is number of prosecutions brought. But that both creates incentives for countries to and rewards countries that, as he said, go after an endless stream of low-level operators rather than put together the resources to go after the entire enterprise. Is any thought being given to adding a new metric or weighting that metric somehow to take into account not just the raw number of prosecutions brought, but the significance of those cases? My second question, when I go on JTIP's website, both JTIP and the TVPA itself are extremely lucid and clear that any commercial sexual exploitation of a minor is a severe form of trafficking. But I have not found analogous clear, bright lines for labor trafficking of minors. In Haiti, I am hearing stories of children as young as 8 being required to work full-time as domestics, not attending schools, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I am familiar with U.S. labor laws on children. I'm just wondering if you're giving any thought to issuing some sort of bright line guidance. Children below this age, children not in school below X age, That would be extremely helpful, just some bright, clear, and I apologize if I haven't found it, but I have more experience looking for these things than the people who have desperate need for that kind of bright, clear guidance. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those are really excellent questions. With regard to the metrics that are used to assess countries for the Trafficking in Persons Report, those are prescribed in law by Congress. And they really focus on the minimum standards that are in the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. They include, are countries criminalizing human trafficking? Are they enforcing those laws? Are they enforcing those laws, the number of investigations, the number of prosecutions? Are they providing victim protections? And then there's some prevention indicia as well. So you ask if there has been, and if anyone given any thought to changing those metrics. I would have to say that, though I don't liaison with the Congress, I think the Congress has looked at that more than once, and there have been several every time when the Trafficking Victims Protection Act is reauthorized. I can't tell you about any current. It was just reauthorized. The president just signed it toward the end of last a couple months ago, which we were all very happy to see. And I don't believe that there were changes at that time. So I think as we look at what countries are doing, we are interested in not just the numbers, but our office gathers information from governments, nonprofits, international organizations, and try to weigh also as much qualitative information we can about what it is that they are doing. It is not just a give us this number and we'll walk away. So there is a dialogue going on with governments, and in many of the narratives you'll actually get some information about the type of case even. So I think for many governments, they're just prosecuting their very first case, and it is true that with a new law in many countries, the anti-trafficking legislation will be new, and all of our prosecutor friends here will tell us that a new law, it takes a long time for people to develop experience with it, to develop how to the good methods of investigation that will lead to solid prosecutions, so it's an incremental and growing process. With regard to changing those metrics, I would just say that it's in the hands of the Congress. We're implementing the law that we have. With regard to child labor, you're right. I think the definitions with regard to child labor and the labor conventions talks about worse forms of child labor in which they include child trafficking. They don't define what child trafficking is. I think we have... I think we have attempted to be quite clear in various narratives in the Trafficking in Persons Report when there are countries where we see child labor, forced child labor that constitutes trafficking, and Haiti is a wonderful example. The Restivic issue in Haiti has been the focus of our narrative for some time now. Our efforts in technical assistance with that government include helping them to enact a comprehensive trafficking statute that would in fact address this particular problem. But Haiti is not alone with regard to this issue, with regard to forced child labor with children. And I do think in the definition section of our report, we attempt to look at what forced child labor is. But your message to me is that we should look at this again, and so I will carry that back. And I appreciate your comments. There are many other countries where this is an issue. It is not just in Haiti that we have discussed it in some length in the Trafficking in Persons Report. And it's a very, very important issue. I'm glad you raised it. Thank you.
With regard to the gentleman who will be next, you can always, if you have a specific metric that you would like to have included. Congress can always do that through the appropriations process. You know, you don't have to wait for reauthorization. So, you know, if there are a couple of, you know, reasonable additions, just put it in the appropriations and they will do it.
Was your letter C, Dimitri the Clever?
Sir?
Yeah, Ken Meyercord, World Docs. Do you ever encounter a lack of appreciation on the part of the victims in that they don't really consider themselves victims, no matter how miserable we may see their situation as being? It's better than what they left back home.
That's, I don't know if anyone wants to say something about it.
We all could. Who wants to answer that?
This is certainly provocative enough, so go ahead.
I think that we do encounter that. It's the standard of the country that the people work in that should be applied to the situation and not the country where the victim comes from. And I think it should really be the standard, and it is the standard. Our Supreme Court stated that a few years ago, but I think that internationally that too is the standard. And you said something about a victim not being grateful. Being a victim doesn't mean that you're a nice or grateful person. You can be a very nasty victim, and you have the right to be that. There's no reason whatsoever that you should be grateful to the people who recover, I think the word should be, you from your plight. And we see that, for instance, with Nigerian girls who come to the Netherlands thinking that, okay, they'll be a victim of prostitution for 8 years, and then after 8 years they'll be a madam themselves. They don't really want to be rescued from that situation because this is for them sometimes a way of getting in the end in a better situation. But that should not stop us from thinking this is not the way a person should live. We consider you a victim, whether you cooperate with the police or not. This is a situation that you're in that is not acceptable. So, yes, we do encounter that, and this is the way we deal with it.
And society itself has to make judgments as to what is acceptable or not. Perhaps an American response to this.
I think in particular as to domestic sex trafficking, part of the forensic psychology of the damage that's done by the offense is trauma bonding with the offender and a lot of coping mechanisms, which include not self-identifying as a victim. So not only do we encounter it, it's pretty much standard operating procedure in a domestic sex trafficking case that you're victim is not going to identify as a victim at all, ever.
And next. Yes, ma'am. Please identify yourself.
I wanted to shamelessly continue Dimitri's point about illegal immigration. Apologies, I'm Megan from MPI. Illegal immigration is such a sticking point in so many different components, from public opinion, so the public may think, we were talking earlier how no one would ever say that they didn't want to combat slavery. Yet at the same time, you might ask a member of the public, do you think that somebody who's working at way lower than minimum wage or even in exploitative conditions should be deported? And they would probably agree with that too. Illegal immigration makes a difference to the supply of readily exploitable labor. It makes the risks much lower for traffickers, and it makes the profits higher. And so I just wanted to ask, in an ideal world, what would the immigration system look like? What would an ideal immigration system look like that would reduce trafficking or combat trafficking?
These are prosecutors.
I'm not exactly sure I could answer that in the way you've asked. I couldn't tell you exactly what the ideal situation is, but I can tell you that I just learned just yesterday that some of the draft immigration legislation includes protections for trafficking survivors. So I'll just approach immigration from the wedge that I'm particularly interested in right now, and I'm pleased to see that. I'm very, very pleased to see that. That's really something that I don't think would have happened 10 years ago. It wouldn't have even happened 5 years ago. So it's very exciting to see that there are considerations for victims of violence as immigration relief is in changes in our immigration statutes are going to be enacted.
And maybe in the Netherlands, to give an example, there are two developments. One is that for a victim, when a victim has been identified by the police, when there's just the slightest idea that this person is a victim, they get the reflection period of, in the Netherlands, 3 months, during which they are offered help and shelter and psychological and judicial help. If they decide to cooperate with the investigation or the prosecution, they will get a temporary residency status, and they can, during that time, also count on help and shelter. But they can also get permit. They also have the permission to work during that time, legally work. Now, this will go on during the time that the prosecution is going on. When the perpetrators have been convicted, not only of the crime of human trafficking, but also of another crime, say the indictment states human trafficking and maltreatment, or any other crime, and there is a conviction of the other crime, not the the trafficking, they will get an extended and a definite possibility to stay in the Netherlands. They get a definite residency permit. Those victims that are too scared or too traumatized to cooperate with the investigation, there is a possibility for them to, when the police deems them to be a victim, to get the same possibilities as the victims that cooperate. Now, there's at this time a lot of to do about being illegal in the country that is going to be criminalized. And there are people who think that would be a bad thing for victims of trafficking, because then they will have an extra crime and they will be afraid to come forward. I do not really share that opinion, because victims of trafficking are being made afraid of everything by their trafficker. And once they are have been identified, there is a certainty that they will not be prosecuted for being illegal. There's a non-punishment clause that will see to that, and there's also the prosecution officers the prosecution that will not do so, because they will need them as a witness in the case.
I should add to this that this follows very closely. I'm not suggesting that who copied whom or whatever it is. Provisions in U.S. immigration law that provides almost exactly the same kinds of protections.
A
temporary visa, which then can convert into a permanent resident visa. And I don't know how much discretion the prosecutor's office has, but, you know, in the United States, there's a lot of discretion, you know, that can go beyond what it is that the law authorizes as to whether to prosecute or not in the event that something like that gets criminalized. Similar.
Thank you for mentioning that. I was only talking about the new legislation, our framework already, that was part of our original legislation to provide this immigration relief. Thank you
recall,
for putting that out.
I recall very clearly. And let me plug the Migration Policy Institute. As of yesterday or Tuesday, whenever it was, we have a detailed analysis of this proposed legislation, all 844 pages of it. No, the analysis is not 844. The legislation is 844 pages. And it can be found at?
Well, it's in the back of the room.
Oh, it's in the back. Right there. It can be found, you see, how instantly we produced it at the back of the room. You can take a copy with you, or you can go on our website and get, if you're curious, particularly for foreign guests and visitors. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Ben Morales from the U.S. Committee refugees and immigrants. And my question was in regards to something that triggered, I've been looking at this immigration reform legislation pretty closely, and there's going to definitely, I think, be a piece that's going to be strong on enforcement, which then I kind of thought, is that going to make it even more difficult for people to come over, which would then make it more expensive, which would then make it more, like, do you foresee that maybe making it more likely that people can be victimized now that it's going to be increasingly difficult to come over? And also in terms of the trafficking piece, they definitely did add something, which is great because it focuses on labor trafficking, which I don't think is something that has really been focused on.
We'll take one more question, and then we'll give an opportunity to the panelists to answer either of these questions or make a final comment. And yes, that's fine.
Thank you all. And
then we'll close and...
Thank you all for your presentations. My name is Alison. I work at the State Department in the Bureau for International
Could
Narcotics.
Could you mind standing up because we cannot hear you?
Sure. I work in the Office of Anti-Crime Programs in the Bureau for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, just down the hall from GTIP. And I'm very interested in the role that corruption plays in facilitating and enabling trafficking. I was wondering if any of you have encountered official complicity in any of the cases that you've worked on, and kind of how you've responded to those cases. Thank you.
And you can fold your answer into your final remarks, too, if you wish.
We haven't had so far that's severe signs of any corruption involved. And I think what we are discovering right now with all our partners involved is that it's more the challenge to be aware of what the problem might look like, because it's not always what you see is not always what it is, and so what we're trying to do is invest in the skills of people in several offices who encounter people that apply for a visa or apply for housing or wanted to be an entrepreneur and need a permit or working a labor permit. What kind of questions you should ask to detect any signals or signs that might give you a side of a possible risk. So it's more right now about awareness and your view of the world, as you might say. And we haven't had so far that many signs of any corruption involved. To be sure, I see my colleagues.
Once we had a case of corruption in a Nigerian case, but
yeah, no structural.
No structural corruption, and it didn't affect our case.
Maybe for my last remark, I would like to answer on an earlier question or comment on an earlier question, and that's about the teaching of judges in Haiti. I think judges, I've been a judge for the best part of my life, I think judges are an extremely difficult group to target because they really know better. They know everything and they know it all better. And if I look at the scenery in the Netherlands, we see the labor inspectorate and we see prosecutors and police and immigration services, that they are all trying to specialize on this very difficult field of human trafficking. And I have advocated for several years now that judges too should be specialized in this very difficult field. And after about 4 to 5 years and 2 extensive research projects on the jurisprudence, I finally succeeded in this. And my report, my latest research on jurisprudence, it will be in English also on my website, because and I hope you can use that too, because most of the legislation that there is worldwide is based on the Palermo Protocol. So a lot of the themes that are predominant in the Palermo Protocol, I have dealt with also in this jurisprudence research. And now in the Netherlands, judges are coming to the courses asking me and my bureau and also the federal prosecutor to come and explain to them about the law, but also, and I think that's very important too, they should not only be taught the law, they should speak with the victim, speak with the police, and see what's really happening on the work floor and what it means to be a victim. So this was my closing remark. Thank you.
Thank you.
Maybe you should mention the website.
Oh, yes. My website is... it's very easy. It is BNRM. BNM. It's on. BNRM. BNRM. .NL.
All right.
And there's a lot of information there, but if you look up National Rapporteur or Human Trafficking in the Netherlands, you'll get there.
You'll find Corinne.
Jane, if you.
Yes.
If
just briefly. Yes, judges like to be trained by judges, and it's which is why we have a relationship with your office to help. And, you know, we have a long history of a crime victims' rights movement here in the United States, and when we were trying to get judges to, this is 25 and 30 years ago, and we were trying to get judges to be more victim-friendly in the courtrooms and to ensure that courtrooms were safe places for victims who were witnesses or family members. We gradually encroached upon the notion that judges would only listen to judges, and gradually we got them to listen to victims and survivors.
All right.
And,
and
I think this is a vehicle that I would recommend to you because it is important as we began to try to tell the story of the impact of crime on victims, and that is that was an important turning point, I think, in terms of judges' education. Now, NGOs, I think, are more, have go in and do more often. Just the two questions quickly. Will increasing security at our borders increase trafficking? I really don't know. I know that our efforts are around building the protections for those who would be suffering enslavement, and to ensure that they have that they're treated not as the criminals because they cross the border, whatever it is, whatever crime might have been committed in the course of being a trafficking victim, that they're not charged for this for such a crime, but instead are treated as a victim that they are. I don't know if that's something we'll have to look and see if that's an unintended consequence. With regard to corruption, a couple of years ago in the Trafficking in Persons Report, we actually published some of the indices related to transparency and corruption. And in fact, you know, corruption undermines rule of law. There's no question that corruption plays a role in human trafficking, because if you don't have a criminal justice system that is fair and honest and reliable that people can turn to, then you're probably not going to have very many cases successfully investigated and prosecuted. So we have found that, that there is a correlation between those things. And
thank you.
That would be all I would have to
thank
say.
Thank you, Jane. I have to find out what your background is, because Jack, if you feel compelled to.
Well, coming from Chicago, of course, we have no public corruption. actually, the public corruption is actually in my bureau as well. And what we've actually found in specifically Chicago, not that it, we don't have corruption problems, because we do, but the traffickers actually, there's more of an indoctrination and lying about what the criminal justice system is and the government as a whole. So a lot of it is really the indoctrination and lies of the traffickers rather than some reality. And they'll actually have, we've had instances where they try to act friendly with law enforcement in the presence of the victims, and the law enforcement is, you know, just eating the donut, having coffee. And there's actually not a corruption about it. And the other aspect of it is sometimes we pose as corrupt police officers during undercover operations, because it allows us to insert ourselves in a transaction that we couldn't consummate in a different undercover capacity. That is an issue, but I haven't actually seen it as it relates to human trafficking in Chicago.
Thank you. Rick, do you have a last word?
Well, general closing remark that we stated already that traditional law enforcement is not enough to tackle this problem. But as one of you stated the question about intel sharing, intelligence sharing, that's not only a technical or judicial problem, it is merely a cultural problem between the institutions. And we here behind the table can give the example. So change begins with us. So if we give a good example, we can reach very far together. And I gave the example this afternoon because we had a big action on the 9th of April about illegal sex abuse via the internet. And we shared our operational action plan for the first time in a task force the 27th of March, so before the action. I wouldn't have done it 2 or 3 years ago, because I think that was a little bit too breakable to do so. But I also experienced that when you trust your partners, you can get something back.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like for all of us to give a hand to this excellent panel.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.